Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Chris Sununu signs a new two-year state budget into law, ending a months-long stalemate. The state's child advocate is reviewing how restraint and seclusion are being used on children in public and private treatment facilities. And can you sue to remove a Christian Bible from the VA lobby if you're a Christian? These and other stories made headlines this week. We'll talk about them in this hour. If you've got questions or comments about the week's news, send them by email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Kevin Landrigan, senior political reporter for the Union Leader, Paula Tracy, reporter for InDepthNH.org, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And thanks to Paula for being here, her weekly New Hampshire News Roundup debut. Paula, we're very excited to have you in particular. It's great.
I'm very excited. Thank you.
We've got so much to talk about today. And let's start with the big news, of course, the budget. I mean, we have a budget now. The governor signed a nearly $13 billion two-year state budget yesterday. Democrats and Republicans both had to give a little in order to reach this deal. So, Paula, we'll start with you. How did the two sides come to this compromise?
Well, I start with the budget hearings that we had in the winter across the state. And we had them in Concord, and there were also ones out in the field. One of them was in Laconia. And I looked at the people in the room in both cases and listened to what they had to say and what their wants and needs were for a biennium budget. And one of the largest groups to attend these were folks with developmental disabilities, their families, and their communities, and about the impacts of the lack of increase in funding for their caregivers. That was a life and death situation for many of these people. We had a wait list for people who needed it. This budget does address their concerns. There will be a 3.1% increase. I guess it's going to go in at the first of the year, Kev?
January, yes.
Yeah. And there'll be another 3.1% increase in the next year of the biennium. There were also many faces of students at the State House and at various events who were talking about the disparity in their education from one town to another and the unfairness that some of kids get to go to have classes like advanced placement classes aren't available in some schools where they are in others. And this goes a long way towards dealing with the losses that they have been suffering. There's going to be another $138 million, I believe, in additional school funding aid, and another $40 million for municipalities to use as they wish. So those are the big things that I think came out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two big issues here that were holding back a final compromise were, as Paula mentioned, education funding, and you know, do you do a one-time grant of additional funds to help, or do you make longer-term commitments to per-pupil spending? So that was one part of the stalemate. The other part of the stalemate, and probably the most kind of red line aspect of this between the two parties, was over business taxes. And Democrats and Republicans just had fundamental differences over the proper level of business taxes, and that really drove a lot of the debate. And they finally came up with this compromise where they're going to keep the business profits tax at 7.7% through 2020. The Dems had wanted to increase it to 7.9%. Sununu had wanted to have it drop down to 7.5%. But they have these triggers in there now where a 6% increase in revenue would trigger an increase in the tax. A 6% decrease in revenue would have the opposite effect. So this was the big issue that was threatening to really scuttle any kind of compromise. And so this now that we have an agreement, I'm thinking about the larger political context here. We just went through this veto override session in which in almost all, I think except for one or two of of Governor Sununu's record number of vetoes, something like 50 or so, were upheld. And that had set really kind of a bitter partisan flavor coming out of that session. Now this is a little bit more, you know, we saw some scenes of bipartisanship, mm-hmm. and this may change a little bit the tenor going into 2020.
Kevin, do you agree this is going to change the tenor?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we're going to have
In the short term.
And we're going to have an election. There sort of was a ceasefire, right? On the partisanship. We have Senate Majority Leader Dan Feltes, who's running for governor in 2020 against Chris Sununu, who's going to seek a third term, actually praising the governor for this compromise. That was a unique moment we've seen. But I really think that what really brought this agreement about was that that Sununu really prevailed in essentially dictating how the additional money would go out. He did not want, as he called it, a structural budget deficit facing the next governor, who he hopes will be him. So a lot of this aid is one-time money. The $40 million in revenue sharing is one time. It's in the first year, and in the second year, it goes away. Much of the $138 million in education aid, almost half of it, is in one-time money. You're using that big surplus you ended June 30th with. More than this budget spends in state spending more than $200 million in the first year than it does in the second year. That's backwards. Usually every budget spends a little more each year, but this governor was okay with that surplus being spent in that first year as long as it didn't add to the base of the budget in the second year. That's what's going to be interesting, and it will take some time because and it will follow the 2020 election, because I can assure you these mayors and selectmen who are going to get these additional monies aren't going to treat them as one time. They're going to be back in the next budget saying, we want the same level of support for public education that you showed in this budget in the next budget.
Well, let's hear from some of the lawmakers who had a hand in the negotiations. And we'll start with Senator Jeb Bradley speaking about the conclusion of these negotiations.
Under Governor Sununu's leadership, we have a fiscally responsible budget that, first and foremost, meets the needs of people in the state of New Hampshire, but more than that, protects a growing economy, because without the incentives that we've created, lower workers' compensation costs, lower business taxes, the economy would not be as strong as it is. And so the dollars that we were able to send back to local communities for property tax relief, either at the school level or municipal level, were made possible by a growing economy. And I think more than anything else, that's critically important.
I agree.
Senator Feltes, what is your view of what just happened?
It's a good compromise for the people of the state of New Hampshire.
Paula Tracy providing us some audio there of lawmakers getting to work. Paula, you also had a chance to talk with Donna Soucy. I want to hear a little bit from her and then again from you, Paula. So here's Donna Soucy talking about the budget compromise.
I think the most important issue is that this is a budget that will serve all of the citizens of the Granite State. It maintains a higher level of education funding than we've provided in the last two decades. It ensures that our healthcare service providers are properly compensated so that they can provide excellent care. It deals with a shortage in our healthcare workforce. And in particular, it provides direct municipal aid, which cities and towns haven't seen in a number of years either. So it's a benefit to taxpayers, it's a benefit to patients, it's a benefit all around.
Benefit all around, both Republicans and Democrats taking to the mic and talking about how happy they are with certain parts of this.
After about 8 months of sitting there and listening to them sort of partisan, you know, back and forth, mm-hmm. it was a wonderful thing to see Senator Feltes basically photobomb Jeb Bradley's interview by jumping in, putting his arm around his shoulder, and the two of them really smiling genuinely as if they really valued each other in a different way than I had seen. Senator Feltes had called the deal the Bradley special on the floor, and meaning that Bradley was able to bring together the governor's real wants and wishes with theirs and work on something that it just seemed a very hopeful tone that has been set after months of losing some of their key issues like Family Medical Leave Act, their gun bills went down. There's this feeling that we got something done for the state. One of the big differences in this that I think is interesting is that it ties funding to free and reduced lunch. This is different than what was passed in June. And the agreement would add higher levels of state aid up to $350 per free and reduced meal eligible student for districts with higher concentrations of free and reduced meals.
So essentially finding a way to send more money to poorer school districts,
right,
like Franklin and Pittsfield.
Right. If they have 12% that are in that eligibility, they get a little bit more money. And it's interesting that they found a way to do that.
Dean?
Yeah. The larger political context here going into the election year is, I think Kevin aptly described this as a bit of a ceasefire. You had a Democratic state legislature legislating a broad array of policy proposals in keeping with the progressive Democratic agenda. You have a Republican governor who vetoed dozens of those pieces of legislation, and most of those vetoes, as I said earlier, were upheld. The budget almost felt like this kind of odd thing that was in the way of 2020 electoral politics. Now that that has kind of been settled, you have this brief ceasefire. We're going to go into next year, and you'll have this discussion or debate between Sununu and whoever the Democratic nominee for governor is about these other issues that Paula just mentioned, you know, gun control, family, medical leave. There's a whole host of issues that Democrats were focused on in the legislative session. And the budget was kind of this thing. It almost felt like they needed to get it out of the way, even though it doesn't embody some core disagreements over the nature of government spending and revenue policy. I think now they're going to shift back to more of a policy-oriented debate in the election year.
So you don't see the candidates running for governor, Sununu or whoever the Democrat may be, sort of using this budget compromise as a way to, you know, bolster their supporters?
Well, I think they'll continue to talk about, particularly on things like education and maybe Medicaid, talk about, the issue of, as Kevin was saying, a one-time commitment versus ongoing commitments. And that's just a fundamental philosophical difference. But there's plenty of other stuff to talk about. And I think this is something that everybody just kind of wanted to get taken care of before we go back to a debate over these other policy issues. But there's no doubt that this will continue to be discussed.
Oh, yeah. And this budget, even though we have a budget deal, how we get there is going to be a big part of this campaign. The Feltes campaign for governor put out a memo after the bill signing on Thursday, which detailed all the ways in which Governor Sununu had proposed more draconian things than he actually ended up signing. That here are the lists of cuts that Governor Sununu had put out as a working document, confidential, by the way. Here, the governor had, according to the Feltes campaign for governor, the governor had wanted a six-month continuing resolution and only agreed to a three-month continuing resolution. That's according to Feltes. And we're going to hear Sununu in his reelection campaign talking about the extreme ideas of the Democrats, that they were going to spend us into oblivion and we were going to end up with an income tax. That's the kind of rhetoric you're going to hear about this budget deal during the campaign. It's going to be very different than what you heard this week.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. You can send your questions about the week's news to us by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Another noteworthy story this week that we should mention is that the state's child advocate, Maura O'Neill, is launching a review of the practice of restraining children at both public and private treatment facilities in the state. Kevin, yeah. Why does the state's child advocate say that this review is necessary?
Yeah, this we've talked about her before, Maura O'Neill, the child advocate, who I think is really doing a great job and providing oversight that was so badly needed. She's looking at this report about seclusion and restraint of children with more than 20,000 incidents over the last 5 years, but there's no documentation of it. In other words, the numbers are just in the aggregate. She knows it deals with about 400 kids who are placed in private detention facilities or residential facilities, I should say, or the Sununu Youth Services Center. But she doesn't know, as she put it, does it represent one child, many kids, one staff member, a particular type of restraint or seclusion? That's what this audit is going to be about, this investigation. And as we've seen before, and we see in the statute that created the Office of Child Advocate, There's not an option. You're going to turn over this information to this child advocate. She's going to get to the bottom of it.
Assuming it exists, right?
Right, exactly. And that's the other hook is she's the first one to kind of look under the hood of these aggregate totals. So you're right, Peter. We really don't know what backup documentation there is here. We hope it's all there, and it's going to take her some time, and she cautioned that, to come up with a complete investigation.
Yeah, and we should recall that the Office of Child Advocate, it's a new office. It's only right. about 4 or 5 years old. Yeah. It was created in 2014, 2015, to deal with a number of, I believe, there are fatalities of children
yes.
in the DCYF system. A tremendous overload in cases, caseworkers woefully under-supported in terms of resources. And so this is really kind of an exercise in trying to understand the parameters of the situation going forward. And as Kevin mentioned, there are a lot of issues about reporting and trying to get a handle on kind of, you know, the overarching policy and then making changes going forward. But as Kevin mentioned, Maura O'Neill has been very active in doing this over the last 3 or 4 years, and it seems to be slowly making a difference.
Yes.
We'll see. I mean, they're still trying to figure it out, in a sense, with this study.
And if you read the article about what she had to say about the practice of restraint in general, she didn't sound too bullish on the idea overall. Like she said, basically, you know, these kids are trying to communicate something, and if you restrain them, you essentially remove their ability to communicate their discomfort
and
whatever
I'm
with them.
I'm not a child psychologist, but there are debates in the profession over the best way to handle kids who are acting out or you know, do you use restraints or do you use some other strategy? And so I think this is part of that larger conversation that she's begun in the state.
Yeah, that was the question I had reading that. Is the hope is that the state would in some ways try to curtail this practice in some way? I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah, it does. And we and the legislature has tackled this issue of defining what's appropriate restraint and seclusion. It's really thorny. And legislature's grappled with trying to find the right balance. The child advocate has had a lot of experience, worked in Maine and Connecticut on these issues as well. So she brings a lot of history to this investigation, which I think will help.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Regarding the child advocate's power, Kevin, what power does she have to sort of enforce anything after this review is completed, or does she have to get the legislature on board?
Yeah, I think there is no central monitoring system to track all these incidents. I think, and I suspect we don't know for certain, but my guess is this investigation and this report from the probe is going to recommend some changes systemically for the legislature to consider to try and more accurately, timely report these incidents, give more transparency about when they occur, where they occur, why they occur, and force all of these facilities basically to defend their practices more than they have to right now.
Also worth noting this week, a story that made headlines, state officials announced this week that it received 13 responses to its request for a proposal to manage sports gambling in New Hampshire. So, Paula Tracy, can you remind us a little bit about how New Hampshire went about making sports gambling a legal thing here?
Yes, this was a bill that passed in the legislature, I do believe, and the idea was to bring it out of the darkness and also provide a source of funding for problem gambling. They got 13 responses to the request. They're going to have both an online contract, and then they're going to have municipalities, which similar to Keno, where if you went to your town meeting, you had to be able to vote it. They're going to do that. They're thinking that they could get roughly $7.5 million in gambling revenue by 2021. They will allow college and sports, but not high school betting, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right. really up to the Lottery Commission to come up with and find the I guess they put the RFPs out for these folks.
They did, and in November they'll be announcing which bidders have been approved for this. Important to point out, can't bet on UNH football. In other words,
or any UNH sports,
or any
right?
New Hampshire-based team,
schools,
Dartmouth
right.
College, any. But everything else is fair game. This is, and as we saw, we had lobbyists register this past year from the NBA, NFL, the Major League Baseball. Professional sports want sports betting. They see this as a very fruitful financial revenue source for them as well, if more and more states get into it.
Yeah, there's a belief among supporters that there's a lot of potential revenue to be gathered out there. You know, the comparison is Keno, which we now have being decided on a town-by-town basis in New Hampshire, and the revenue projections have fallen far short. I think just a couple million rather than 10 or 11 million over a few years. And so the expectation is this is going to bring in a lot of money. Perhaps it'll be more a more dependable source of revenue than Keno has turned out to be, but this has been a lot of pressure for this. This is nationwide. Sports betting is just colossal at this point.
Yeah, Paula.
The House voted 269 to 82 to allow it, and this is all following a 2018 Supreme Court ruling. So this wasn't really allowed until recently, and a lot of other states are looking.
Yeah,
at
the
it
issue
as
there
well.
Was the online using online lottery systems. There was
the crossing federal, state lines.
There was
part
yeah
was
there
a
was
problem.
A there yes. was a federal court case that yep. had kind of I believe a change in rules by the Trump administration or current rules were problematic, and it went through the courts, and now everything's on.
And so when Keno passed, it was passed with the understanding that money would be used for kindergarten.
Yeah.
That eventually was decoupled, but was there something similar here? Was that $7.5 million that was anticipated by 2021, Paula, earmarked for something in particular, or was that just general fund?
No, it's not.
Just general fund?
No, it just goes to the lottery, and then for education, all lottery money, all lottery profits go to education. So if sports betting is really profitable, then that means more education aid to communities.
There is money there for a commission to look at problem betting and advertising and connecting people who have problems with services that they would have. So there is some targeted money, and there is a commission to oversee.
Mm-hmm. And there's something called in-game betting, where you bet on plays during the game, and some say that's increased the addictive nature of the game, but there's no prohibition on that yet.
That was a sticking point. There were some concerns about that when the hearings were held, but they decided not to go down that road. Is that
right?
You're understanding?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests today about the week's news, and we're here to answer your questions if you've got them. So send them along by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday on The Exchange, we follow up on the hearings over safety at the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant. If you've got questions or comments, send them now by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, and tune in live at 9 on Monday for that conversation about Seabrook. Right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. In the studio with me, Paula Tracy, reporter for InDepthNH.org, Kevin Landrigan, senior political reporter for The Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Let's start this part of the program talking about bail reform, which has been an ongoing conversation in the state for a while now. Kevin, the Union Leader reported this week that police in Manchester are not happy with the way the recent bail legislation signed by the governor is impacting their work. How do they say it's impacting their work?
Well, they last year, Governor Sununu signed bail reform, which really curtailed the use of cash bail to keep defendants in jail before trial. Now, Chief Carlo Capano essentially is saying that Manchester is having an increasing problem with homelessness, and that they claim they're suffering these consequences that that in other words, that some people are being cited a dozen times for violations of ordinances and misdemeanors. They don't go to court; they remain free. And even though serious crime in Manchester went down 8% so far this year, they're still having this problem with, in their minds, unaccountable people who are committing multiple minor offenses and are still allowed out on the street.
So now, under the current process, clear, like someone who has committed a nonviolent offense, maybe they're caught with drugs or something like that. They go to court. The judge says, well, we can't prove that you're dangerous, so we can't hold you on cash bail. And so they let them go on personal recognizance.
Correct.
And the risk, they're supposed to be on their best behavior until they have that court date, which they show up for voluntarily. And the police are saying these people are not behaving themselves well in between being let go and showing up for court, right? Is that essentially it?
Yeah, that's essentially it. Now, the governor's folks and supporters of bail reform point out that any judge is allowed to deny bail to any person they believe is a threat to public safety. So if prosecutors can show that any defendant represents a danger to the community or himself, he could be jailed without bail. The supporters of bail reform essentially say then real problem actors can be kept in jail without bail. This bail reform does not endanger the public, but the Manchester police chief and Manchester police did support bail reform when it went through and the revisions went through last year. But the Manchester police chief said in implementation, we're having these issues with homeless folks.
Yeah, and the experience here in New Hampshire fits into a broader debate around the country over criminal justice reform. And the argument for people who support the bail reform is that under the old system, you'd have people who maybe they're homeless or maybe they're dealing with addiction issues and they're committing these petty crimes, but they have no money for bail, so they're essentially sitting in jail for a long time for very minor offenses. So that's one side of the argument. And the other side, as Kevin articulated, is law enforcement saying that this is creating a lot more problems for us. Some of these folks may genuinely be dangerous, but at a minimum, it requires a lot of manpower to deal with these folks, just these recurring week after week problems with some of these individuals.
Yeah, well, important to point out, I was just going to say, important. Just this past June, even more revisions to bail reform went into effect, including allowing a judge to consider information about dangerousness that would include substance abuse and homelessness. So supporters of bail reform, like Buzz Short, the UNH law professor, essentially is saying to the Manchester police chief, let these new revisions work. They can even deal with people who you think are dangerous who are also homeless.
Paula?
It seems like it's an issue specific to Manchester for some reason, but I'm wondering whether the pains of this are also being felt across the state. Have you had a chance to talk to any folks in the law enforcement communities and see how it's happening in other cities that don't have perhaps as big a homeless issue? Are they also having a problem, Kev?
They are. I mean, Andrew Shigori, who's the immediate past president of the State Association of Chiefs of Police, said many chiefs are getting growingly frustrated with this. Even like, for example, the Ossipee District Court, certainly not a urban area, has nearly 800 bench warrants pending, which can be for many things, including not showing up for trial, and that the police. The Tufton Borough Police Chief Shigori says that sometimes jail can be beneficial in a temporary way as a kind of time out to put someone who, when there's a domestic situation, can put someone really at harm's way if you can separate them and put them in jail for a period of time, not permanently, but just for a period of time. That can calm things down.
Mm-hmm. And so... worth mentioning, since we're curious about who this might be affecting in the state, that listeners, if you have a personal story about this bail system, if you've been involved in it somehow and been affected by it, we'd love to know about that. We may not be able to get your comment on the air today, but please do send us your story by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. We'd be really interested in hearing your perspective firsthand on how bail reform is working or not working, in your view. The governor has indicated, Paula, that he's kind of interested in seeing if this needs to be revised or tweaked. He might be supportive of that, he's indicated. And so the police are taking to the public forums, news outlets. Is this perhaps an indication that police in Manchester would be interested in working with the governor to change things?
I think it offers an opportunity for everyone to sit down and work out the issues that they have and to come up with something that might work better for everybody. It's not set in stone, but the people who are impacted should be at the table.
Well, we are going into an election year, and law enforcement has traditionally been a strong backer of the governor, and so he certainly wants to pay attention to their concerns.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. Send us your questions or comments about the week's news, exchange@nhpr.org. Paula, you reported for InDepthNH.org this week on climate strikes happening across the state. You attended one in Plymouth. But
yes,
there were many going on.
Yes, I went to the one that was closest, so I had the least carbon footprint.
Okay.
I went to the PEMI, I think it was called the PEMI Action Strike. It was called the PEMI Climate Strike. It was in Plymouth. It filled the center with children and music and adults and dogs and speakers from many organizations. And it was among 10 events that were held around the state. There were similar events in Manchester, Keene, Hopkinton, Durham, Nashua, Bethlehem, Conway, Portsmouth, and there was one on the Statehouse lawn. Mm. And what they really want is an end to fossil fuel burning or a reduction. And they don't feel, driven mostly by children, that the adults are doing enough. And I see this becoming a major issue in the political, the campaigns going forward, driven by children. I mean, there were 150 countries participating. Over 5 million people took to the streets last Friday. And I was getting information following up about organizations that are looking to get volunteer training. There's also volunteer opportunities to get this on the front burner, particularly in New Hampshire, where we have an opportunity to talk to a number of presidential candidates. We were part of In-Depth New Hampshire of Covering Climate Now, which was a international effort by journalists all over the world to address climate. And in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be doing some more work on the environment that New Hampshire has, on our endangered species, and on what climate is happening.
One more question for you, Paul. I want to hear Dean's comments, which is, you know, were these activists, protesters, calling for lawmakers to support any particular piece of legislation, either on the state or federal level?
There are a couple legislative things that are happening mostly in Washington, and there isn't consensus. The Green New Deal, many people think that is a pathway forward. A lot of other people feel it's very expensive. There wasn't a specific thing that they wanted, but there is this focus on reducing the amount of fossil fuel burning, to look individually at what you can do, and then statewide, and then nationally and globally, and to move out from there. And that I think the takeaway for many people who I spoke to, many of children, are teenagers, was there are little things that they can do. They don't feel helpless about this. They don't feel discouraged. They feel empowered, and it'll be interesting to see how this issue plays out in the campaigns going forward.
Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a very complex issue politically. It's certainly an issue of high importance among the Democratic primary electorate. I'm not quite as sure that it's going to resonate in the same way in a general election. Republicans just have a fundamentally different view about it. Maybe those differences will in some way activate the debate, but it typically gets pushed down a little bit by other concerns dealing with jobs, healthcare, the economy, and national security. That's traditionally how it's played out in general elections. So it is a generational issue. I think over time you will see the issue being addressed more and more as a younger generation takes the reins of policy and legislating. But, you know, the Trump administration is moving in the opposite direction. The EPA is rolling back a number of things dealing with auto emission standards and, you know, and other types of deregulatory actions that will actually encourage more fossil fuel use. And so a lot of it, I think, as Paula was saying, is going to be doing things at the local level, maybe at the state level, and waiting until the climate changes in, at the national level in terms of who's controlling the government. But it was amazing to see around the world the level of interest and activism. But it just right now we're at a bit of a stalemate in the big picture because the Trump administration has a very different set of policies.
Kevin.
Yeah, and I think even nationally the Democratic Party is really struggling with this. That's why the Democratic National Committee has refused to have a debate on climate change, just on climate change.
There have been debates on it, just not from the committee.
That's correct.
Yes, yeah,
that's correct.
Cable outlets have done it.
There have been forums by interest groups.
Yeah, and cable outlets.
Okay.
Yeah.
And look at the candidates who had the most aggressive climate change agenda. They're out of the race. Jay Inslee was the best on climate change. John Hickenlooper was great on climate change. They're both out of the race. I mean, the Democrats, many Democratic candidates who are running for president have supported carbon taxes while serving in Congress, but they haven't come up with a carbon tax plan during the presidential campaign because they know it's a big tax increase. And to Dean's point, in a general election, it's not wholly a winning issue. But Democrats have a real problem, and that is these millennials, these younger voters, like Paula said, this is what they care about most. And if you're not addressing it in the fall of 2020, many of them probably aren't going to vote for you. So that Democratic presidential nominee is going to have to really walk a tightrope.
It puts them in a tough spot. And the rationale behind the DNC not having a climate change debate is their concern was that you get 10 people on the stage and it's going to be a race to the largest, most extreme, most expensive version of climate change.
Right.
And then that's going to be thrown back at the Democratic nominee in the general election. It is a very difficult issue to navigate.
Well, Paula, you mentioned that you will be reporting more on this for InDepthNH.org, yes?
Yes, I am.
Okay. What are you looking forward to next?
Well, I'm really interested in New Hampshire's endangered species. We have almost 40 critters that are out there that have very, very limited environments that they live in. And New Hampshire is blessed to have an Arctic zone up the top of Mount Washington and an ocean. So we can have piping plovers on the ocean, and we can have these tiny little butterflies that are only found at the top of Mount Washington, the White Mountain fritillary. I wrote about that. And I'm looking for more good stories and good ideas from folks on how our environment can be changed and how that can either benefit or harm our most vulnerable species.
Well, just a reminder to listeners that we have linked to Paula's stories at indepthnh.org at our website, nhpr.org, as well as all of the stories we're discussing today on this, the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Other stories we've reported this week. The EPA says that New England has met air quality standards for sulfur dioxide after improvements were seen in parts of New Hampshire. Sulfur dioxide comes mostly from power plants and other industrial facilities. Improvements were credited to a sulfur dioxide emission control system at the Merrimack Power Station installed in 2012. Also, the Manchester VA is breaking ground today on its new mental health urgent care building. The 16,000-square-foot addition will support current and future outpatient urgent care and mental health services. It also will offer an entrance with curbside access to urgent care. And the federal government is shutting down recreational cod fishing in the Gulf of Maine from October 1st until the end of April next year. The Gulf of Maine once teemed with cod, but populations are much lower now. Recreational fishermen are still allowed to possess one cod per day until September 30th. So let's spend a little time talking about the national political environment right now and also the 2020 campaign. Really quickly, because we've covered a lot about this on the national level this week, New Hampshire's two members of the House of Representatives, Annie Custer and Chris Pappas, Dean, both publicly announced support for an impeachment inquiry. earlier this year. Dean, to what extent is the rest of the country sort of catching up with them, given the whistleblower allegations we heard about this week?
Well, this whistleblower allegation really seems to have kind of lit a fire under the idea of an impeachment inquiry. You're seeing poll numbers shift now from only a minority of voters, a small minority supporting impeachment, to I still think we're under a majority of voters, but it has now surpassed not impeachment. It's like 43-40 or 46-43 in favor, something like that. So the numbers are clearly shifting as a result of this. No surprise to see Democratic members of Congress supporting this inquiry. Just a quick framework. You've got six committees investigating President Trump in the House. The House Intel Committee will take the lead on the inquiry as the others wrap up their investigations. Formal articles of impeachment would likely come out of the Judiciary Committee at some point and then potentially onto the floor of the House. You need a majority in the House to impeach. You need two-thirds of the Senate in the Senate trial to remove impeachment. They have enough votes now if they want to do it. Some are saying maybe by Thanksgiving. Removal in the Senate after a trial, not anywhere close to 67 senators. You know, you have a Republican majority, and most of those folks so far have either been silent on this Ukrainian issue. They've either been silent or they've come out in defense of the president.
Mm-hmm. One thing related to 2020 we can talk about briefly before the break, which is that a new Monmouth poll shows Elizabeth Warren pulling ahead of Joe Biden, who has so far been the front runner in recent 2020 Democratic primary polls. Warren had 27% to Biden's 25%. Paula, what do you make of that?
Well, I went to the big event at the U.S. I guess it was the Democratic convention 2 weeks ago, and heard from 19 of the candidates. And I didn't I was absolutely blown away by Elizabeth Warren's organizational and the success. It went from being a very warm reception that all the candidates got, but when she entered the room, it was like a rock concert. She brought the house down, and I stood up and thought, wow, that wasn't something that I had expected to see.
Well, this is something we'll talk a little bit more after the break. Lots to say about this. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll talk about the 2020 race, but also one more story of particular interest this week. Does a Christian have standing to sue the VA over the presence of a Bible? Can you be injured by the presence of your own religious text in a federal building? It's a complex question that a judge is mulling right now. We'll get down to the details after a break. If you've got questions or comments about that story or anything else happening in the news this week, send it by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
What just happened?
This is all wrong.
It's all a hoax.
It's deeply troubling.
Speaker Pelosi happens to be the Speaker of this House.
No one is above the law.
But she does not speak for America when it comes to this issue.
It's been a historic week, and events are still moving fast. We'll take a breath and explain the what and the why on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
A pledge-free edition of the Friday News Roundup, this morning at 10, here on the special pledge-free stream on nhpr.org. Turning partly to mostly sunny for today, with high temperatures upper 60s to lower 70s. It'll be mostly clear tonight. Overnight lows from lower 40s northern New Hampshire, ranging lower 50s in the south. Saturday, partly to mostly sunny, high temperatures mid to upper 70s. It'll be mostly sunny on Sunday, with highs from lower 60s in the north country, ranging lower 70s in the south. You're listening to the special pledge-free stream on nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan, senior political reporter for the Union Leader, and Paula Tracy, reporter for InDepthNH.org. I'm Peter Biello. Great to be here with you this morning. We were talking a little bit before the break about Elizabeth Warren pulling ahead in the recent Monmouth poll, her 27% to Joe Biden's 25%. But there's another part of this poll that I wanted to put to all of you and get your thoughts on it, which is, I guess I'll just read directly from the summary of the poll. So to quote them, their results show most New Hampshire Democratic primary voters, 61%, say if they had to choose, they would select a candidate who they don't agree with on most issues, but would be stronger against President Donald Trump in the general election. On the other hand, 27% say if they had to choose, they would support a candidate they agree with on the issues, even if that person would have a hard time beating Trump. So maybe start with you, Dean Spiliotis, on this. What does this say about the state of mind of Democratic voters to you?
That they want to remove President Trump from office. But I will say that there's a long tradition in political science of studying this exact phenomenon. And what you find is when push comes to shove, voters always choose removing the nominee of the other party over picking someone that fits their core ideological preferences.
Oh, so this is not unusual.
No, this is not unusual at all. What you typically find is early in a primary season, voters focus more on kind of ideological fit and their policy preferences. But over time, as the horse race increases, and that's the increasing nature of the reporting, people always shift to, I'll take anybody from my party over the person from the other party as long as my party can win. So yeah, this is a very typical phenomenon for voters. They just want to win. You know, as for Elizabeth Warren, I've been asked now repeatedly, is she the new front runner? She's clearly been building momentum slowly but surely. As Paula mentioned, she has a strong organization here and in Iowa. And so I think we need to have a little more time and some more polls. She's ahead by two here. She's ahead by two in the latest Des Moines Register poll in Iowa. So clearly something is changing. You know, do we have a two-person race? Maybe. Bernie Sanders has receded a little bit in these polls down into the lower teens. So the answer is that the verdict is still out on whether or not she's the new front runner. The other question here, the wild card, is the whole impeachment inquiry and Joe Biden and Hunter Biden's being pulled into that. That's a double-edged sword for Biden. On the one hand, it gives President Trump something fair or not to tarnish his candidacy with. On the other hand, it gives him a platform. Anytime Trump attacks him, he's going to get a high visibility opportunity to respond. And some people may think, well, you know, if Trump really seems to be afraid of Biden, so maybe he's the way to go if we want to win. So that's the big wild card in all of this. But there's no doubt that she is really challenging Biden for a front runner status.
Yeah, the polling with regard to electability and likability, I do think we're in that romance stage of this campaign. And by that I mean this, is that there is a synergy right now for many voters in this primary, that the person they agree with on the issues is actually the one who's electable in their mind. Now, to Dean's point, once you have a nominee, that calculus changes. But right now, you're desperately trying to merge both. You want Trump gone, but you also want to agree with the person who might take out Trump. So, you know, in your brain, you do this psychological argument with
That's
yourself,
right.
And you essentially say, well, the person I agree with the most, actually, they are the most electable. I do think that's what we're seeing with Warren. Meaning, she went hard left. I mean, people forget that everybody wants impeachment in this presidential race, except Tulsi Gabbard, okay? But back in April, nobody did. All the candidates were playing it safe. Remember Joe Biden calling it a gigantic distraction, even an impeachment inquiry. Elizabeth Warren called for impeachment back in April. And I think it caused a lot of primary voters to look at her differently. And the other thing about Elizabeth Warren is she figured out a way. Dean and Paul will remember at the beginning, why isn't Elizabeth Warren more likable? You know, she had the Hillary problem. She figured out a way to tell her life story in a very compelling way that resonated with voters and matched up with the issues. As someone, a single mother who was going to community college on a student loan, who struggled to pay the bills and ends up becoming, you know, it is a real success story, but ends up becoming the highest paid professor at Harvard University, living in a $3 million Victorian in Cambridge. I mean, so, and I think she figured out a way to tell that story that really galvanized voters to take a look at her seriously.
And can I go to Paula for a moment first? Because, Paula, you were covering there on the ground, and you like to talk to voters. So, how are the voters responding to the story that Kevin is describing?
Well, I went to this event
to really hear from younger people and who was there. And I had seen Warren earlier, and she took me back as a very different candidate, just like Kevin was saying. She wasn't shrill, and she wasn't being demonic. She was being calm. She had a totally new demeanor. She had a new sense of herself that really came out. And many of the people that I actually talked to were big Kamala Harris supporters. Harris had apparently gotten a bus or two in Boston, and these kids got on board. And their issues were race relations in the country and also climate and environmental issues. And I think there is a huge opportunity for a number of candidates to fill that second role. And I really am excited to see in the next 3 to 4 months how that shakes out, who ends up being who comes out of New Hampshire. Because Elizabeth Warren lives in Massachusetts and it's a neighboring state, people just assume that gives her the leg up. But who else is out there who would be able to carry out of New Hampshire and get some more momentum.
So before I want to get Dean's take on one thing here. I mean, we're talking about a couple of things that are very gendered and very sensitive, right? And we should be at least aware of them, which is that we're talking about someone who is likable, but we also need to talk about all the candidates and whether or not they are likable. Yeah. And that the word shrill is very charged, especially when it comes to women candidates. So I just want to make sure that we're aware that we're talking about this, and we want to be sensitive to the biases that we are either conscious of or not conscious of. And it's something that women candidates have to deal with, and that's an unfortunate reality.
Yeah, it's just as you said, it's a reality. And you know, there are favorability and electability numbers on all the candidates for sure. The challenge for Elizabeth Warren going forward is you know, she's doing well in Iowa and New Hampshire. Those are largely white, affluent states. And South Carolina has always been viewed as Joe Biden's backstop. He has very strong support among the African-American community. Polling data shows Elizabeth Warren's support is primarily high-income, high-education whites. That's slowly changing. She's picking up some ground among African-American voters, but she still has some work to do. Now, it may be the case that, you know, if she wins Iowa and New Hampshire, you may get this kind of tipping point and it won't matter. But there still are questions about how she runs in places like Nevada, which we'll have actually before South Carolina. And then I think the Biden folks see South Carolina as their backstop. And so that's looking down the road a little bit. That's going to be the big challenge for her.
Other stories that we've been reporting this week at NHPR. The Claremont City Council approved a policy Wednesday night for displaying religious and secular symbols in a city park during the holidays. The new policy is designed so that there are diverse displays and one belief is not promoted over another. The policy will be drafted into an ordinance and then presented at a public hearing. Also, the number of hepatitis A cases in the state is rising. The Department of Health and Human Services, more than 200 people have been diagnosed with the disease since last November. One person in Merrimack County has died. State officials say homeless people are vulnerable to the disease since they don't often have access to bathrooms, showers, or clean laundry. And the Portsmouth Police Commission voted unanimously this week against the use of body cameras. A report produced by a citizen subcommittee estimated the cost for body cams to range from $400,000 to $700,000 over the span of 5 years. The group recommended the commission not adopt body cams, even if the cost was less. Just a reminder to our listeners that any story that you hear us discuss today, or the stories you hear in our newscast, for that matter, are available online at our website, nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Also this week in the news, something worth talking about. The UL and NHPR reported this week that a federal judge is weighing whether a veteran who is a Christian has standing to sue the Manchester VA over a Bible displayed in the lobby. It's part of the POW/MIA missing man table. This week, the judge denied without prejudice the VA's motion to dismiss the lawsuit. The VA was challenging the veteran's grounds to sue because the veteran is a Christian. So the question became in the courtroom, can a Christian be offended by a Christian Bible in the VA's lobby? The veteran suing James Chamberlain, his lawyer, Larry Volgeman, said Absolutely, yes. A veteran can be offended by the presence. And here he is. Here's Larry Vogelman speaking on the steps of the federal courthouse in Concord.
Every time he's forced to go by it, he thinks of those he served with who weren't Christian. And he thinks of those who gave their ultimate sacrifice of their lives to defend our country and our Constitution. And not all of them were Christian. And that, you know, that hurts him to the quick.
So Vogelman saying his client is hurt to the quick by this. The VA disagreeing. And Kevin, the UL's reported on this. What's your take on the story?
Yeah, it's an interesting case. I mean, Judge Paul Barbadero, who's sitting on this case, real smart guy. And he points out there's all kinds of case law about this. Would Muslims and Jews have sued over crosses and creches in town, in public squares, and atheists have challenged the placement of the Ten Commandments in a courthouse. But does a Christian who's a follower of the Bible have standing? And can that person have harm? And Larry Vogelman, who's a great defense lawyer, made a compelling argument. But to his point, as any good lawyer, if Barbadero rules against him, he's got a fallback position, which is he can add a non-Christian as a plaintiff. There were 14 veterans that have taken issue with the Bible at the Manchester VA table, and some of them are not Christian. So once we get this threshold move and ruling by Judge Barbadero, we may have an amendment to the complaint in order to keep the complaint alive.
And one of the arguments for the VA made on behalf of one of the interveners in the courthouse steps, which is, listen, anybody can sort of apply to have one of these displays put in.
Right.
So it's not necessarily favoring one religion over another. But that's a story that's going to evolve. Before we go, I want to hear from each of you really quickly about what you'll be covering in the coming week. Well, maybe we'll start with you, Paula.
Well, I am working on a story about a new senior center that's being developed in the Conway area, and how it could be a day facility used for other places in the state.
Kevin.
Special election on October 8th for a House seat in Epping. A really competitive race between former Chief of Staff to Carol Shea Porter and a former Republican state representative should give us an early indication of where all the energy is.
And Dean, what will you be looking at?
Looking at the interaction between these new developments on the impeachment inquiry and the Joe Biden and the Democratic presidential race. Another subplot here: Corey Lewandowski is being mentioned as someone who might lead an anti-impeachment team for President Trump. He's been talking about running for Senate. So there's just a lot of intersecting points here.
All right. Well, I want to thank all our guests for being here today: Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU; Paula Tracy, senior reporter for InDepthNH.org, making her debut today. Thank you, Paula. We appreciate you being here. And Kevin Landrigan, senior political reporter for The Union Leader. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for tuning in for the roundup this week. We'll catch you next week. Have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.